Chapter 8. Solomon's Coats. Cotton, America, and Trade. Runaways. One of our sins as a nation is the way we indulge the slaves in sinful finery. We let them dress too much. It led them astray. We will be punished for it. A Southern lady overheard in a South Carolina hotel, 1862. In early August 1851, Solomon ran away. At 45, he was nearly twice the age of the average runaway, but still strong enough to survive the rigors of the cross-country route from Hollow Springs, Georgia, to a free state further north. Well-built and of medium height, at around 5 feet 8 inches, he had neither noticeably light nor dark skin. He lacked the conspicuous features, such as missing teeth or toes, scars on shoulders or cheeks that slave owners usually remarked upon. He was therefore relatively incognito in his own skin. He had other advantages. As a first-rate smith, he was likely to find a job elsewhere with ease. Solomon was also taciturn by nature, saying little, except when intoxicated, and so less likely to betray himself. He had also planned ahead, taking his entire wardrobe, 2 pair new copperas pants, 1 black jeans frock coat, 1 red and black sack coat, 1 walnut-dyed sick sack coat, 1 black fur hat, 1 pair store shoes. We know about Solomon and his coats because of a notice the slave owner John Duncan placed for his capture in the Southern Banner on the 7th of August, along with the offer of $100 to the person who returned him. The pages of American newspapers during the 18th and 19th centuries were peppered with such runaway notices, especially in the South. They were generally signposted with a small image of a vagabond with a bundle slung over his back, or a seated black woman wearing a white dress, and were scattered over pages advertising goods, services, or yet more slaves for sale. At first, they were placed for any apprentice, servant, or dependent who absconded. In 1855, the fond husband of Anna Maria wrote that whoever returns her will get his head broke. But soon enough, they were dominated by the hunt for the black men and women determined to head north or east, either back to Africa or, later, to England, where they hoped they might find refuge and freedom. Runaway ads make curious sources, at once intimate and impersonal. One oddly consistent feature is their preoccupation with clothing. They teem with minute details about the slaves' garments. Preston, sought by John H. Smith in March 1847, was wearing a grey cloth overcoat, negro cloth pantaloons, and a new cloth velvet cap when he absconded. Another man wore a very good hat, a pair of white homespun pantaloons, a copperas grounded vest with a blue piece in the back. One wore shoes with unmatched buckles, another a waistcoat with pewter buttons up one side. Bonner, who ran away the week before Christmas in 1772, was a new Negro. That is, had only recently been taken from Igbo country in Africa, and wore correspondingly new shoes and stockings, the latter being knit and spotted black and white. Clothing, in fact, was specified in over 3/4 of the runaway advertisement, and was the most popular thing for runaways to take with them, over seemingly more fundamental items such as tools, weapons, money, even food. Some of the reasons why runaways like Solomon, Bonner, and Preston preoccupied themselves with clothing were highly practical. Slave owners, if they bought clothes or fabric for their slaves, looked for 2 things in their purchases: longevity and price. And as a rule, they bought in bulk. John Ray, an owner who kept meticulous records in a plantation book, was likely typical in purchasing slave clothing yearly. For example, he bought 13 pairs of Negro shoes at 1.06 a pair in 1853. Frequent advertisements tempted slavers with Negro clothing sold low for cash, bales of cheap Negro cloth, or very cheap cotton pantaloons at cheapest prices. As a result, many slaves, particularly field hands, wore a distinctive and near-identical array of drab, hard-wearing clothing. A notice in 1767 for a slave less well-prepared than Solomon specified only that the runaway wore the usual clothing of labouring Negroes. In a city or a free state, such meagre, low-status garb would mark the wearers as runaways at a glance. Clothing could also function as a form of currency, either exchanged for other garments or for cash, helping to finance a slave's flight. But the clothing also served a subtler function. This was an era with a rich visual culture. Perception, seeing and being seen were key to consumption. "Our sight," wrote Joseph Addison, the English essayist and politician, "is the most perfect and delightful of all our senses." Those of lower social status were, on the one hand, supposed to be visually distinct from those higher up the social orders, while on the other, remain inconspicuous. In paintings and prints, where they are included at all, slaves are either scattered around picturesquely doing their work, or depicted in obviously secondary subservient roles. Take Edouard Manet's Olympia, painted in the mid-19th century and first exhibited in Paris in 1865. While it transgressed conventional mores in one way, depicting a prostitute boldly meeting the viewer's gaze, the black servant remains in the background, uncomfortably crouched so as not to loom over her white mistress, humbly offering her a bouquet of flowers. A majority of written sources share this skewed vision. Travel journals, diaries, and letters, consumed and composed by wealthy whites, skim over servants and slaves, mentioning them most frequently when they transgressed, becoming, by these lapses, suddenly visible. It was during this period, and in part because of the economics of the slave trade, that cotton became the preeminent fabric of the West. From this time until the late 1970s, when synthetics gained ascendancy, cotton accounted for the majority of fibres used globally. From the workaday t-shirt and jeans of the beatniks to the most inflated thread count sheets in luxury Tokyo hotels, cotton is a default fabric choice and one of the most common mediums through which we materially express our status and identity. This was also the case for the people taken from Africa to the Americas to be slaves. It gave them a means to claw back some measure of self-respect and individuality. Cotton, one of the cornerstones of the Atlantic slave trade, was simultaneously a medium through which identities were crafted and asserted. Cotton was a common crop throughout Africa. The great Andalusian Arab traveller Al-Bekri, who visited Mali as early as 1068, wrote that every house had its cotton bush, and cloths of fine cotton were traded by locals for salt, millet, fish, butter, indigo, and meat. Alardo Equiano, who purchased his freedom in 1766 after years of enforced labour, and went on to become an author and a prominent anti-slavery advocate, wrote one of the few accounts that mentions his clothing prior to capture. "The garb of both sexes in Guinea," he wrote, "consisted of a long piece of calico or muslin wrapped loosely round the body, somewhat in the form of a Highland plaid." Then, as now, there was a great variety of cloth and clothing across the continent, with garments determined by means and custom. In the 1930s, an African-American called Cheney Mack recalled that "it went purty hard with her father, brought over at the age of 18, having to wear clothes, live in houses, and work," the implication being that he was used to wearing nothing at all. This is likely her own interpretation of living conditions in her father's home country, rather than the reality. Elsewhere, just as some Europeans embraced chinoiserie, some African elites, particularly those living near coastal trading posts, wore European-style clothes as a status symbol, signalling their own knowledge of exotic foreign tastes. Once slaves, however, no matter what their preferences, they were stripped and forcibly dressed in the clothes suited, in the minds of those who traded them, to their status. The clothes a slave officially wore thenceforth depended on the means and inclinations of the owners. One large plantation routinely gave adult field hands 7 yards of coarse osnaburg, 3 of check cloth, and 3 of woolen baize each October, leaving them to actually make the clothes themselves. Slaves destined to work inside, and who would therefore be more visible, were generally better dressed. Some owners bought ready-made clothes, others all but left their slaves to fend for themselves. In hottest summer and coldest winter, Frederick Douglass recalled after his escape to freedom, I was kept almost naked. No shoes, no stockings, no jacket, no trousers, nothing on but a coarse tow-linen shirt, reaching only to my knees. My feet have been so cracked with the frost that the pen with which I am writing might be laid in the gashes. In 1735, a law was passed in South Carolina that limited the materials slaves could wear to the cheapest, meanest available. While this was often flouted, it's true that the same fabrics crop up in descriptions again and again. Negro cloth, mentioned frequently, generally referred to white Welsh plains, a cheap woolen cloth imported from Britain, sold at around 80 cents per yard in the early 19th century. Other common fabrics for men's clothing included broadcloth, jean, and osnaburg. Broadcloth was, like plains, made from wool, but jean and osnaburg were usually made from cotton. The latter was a coarse, plain-woven fabric. Jean was a twill weave, making it more durable and giving it characteristic diagonal ribs. Confusingly, jeans as we know them today are usually made of denim, a different fabric. The most frequently mentioned fabric, however, was homespun. This, as the name suggests, was made either by the slaves themselves on the plantation or by a nearby supplier, and was a plain weave of either wool or cotton, depending on what was most readily and cheaply available. Women wore gowns of homespun or of calico, another plain woven cotton usually decorated with a small-scale pattern, stripes or checks. The commonest colours were brown and blue, both of which could be obtained from dyestuffs available nearby, such as indigo and walnut, the latter used to colour one of Solomon's coats, and white. Writing in the Southern Watchman in 1855, for example, a Dr. Terrell contended that while a slave was provided for, a labourer must save enough to buy his clothes, and he must have his clothes washed and mended. This neatly ignored the dehumanising effects of an imposed uniform made from the dreariest and cheapest fabrics available. White Americans, for all the rhetoric about modest dressing and the sin of vanity, eschewed these materials whenever they could. Clothing was, in other words, another landscape over which the dynamics of power were played out. Rough and coarse rather than smooth, loose rather than fitted, dingy rather than brightly coloured, scratchy rather than soft, lustreless rather than sheened, slave clothing as procured and defined by whites visually demarcated their low status. At least, that was the intention. In practice, slaves not only proved eminently capable of obtaining clothing theoretically forbidden to them, but also of carefully and intentionally carving out an aesthetic altogether their own. Doing so meant getting their own clothes, or at least visually distinguishing themselves. Many, for example, were disinclined to wear white because it was so associated with slave clothing. This was leveraged by perceptive slave owners. In the 1780s, the Reverend Henry Lawrence wrote that any Negro who has behaved remarkably well should be given something better than the white plains. A similar prejudice existed against shirts made from Osnaburg, this being the archetypal garment of field hands. Those emancipated revelled in their sartorial as well as their literal freedom. Alarda Equiano immediately began giving and attending dances, to which he wore superfine blue clothes, in which, he wrote proudly, he made no indifferent appearance. Those still enslaved expended considerable energy to collect desirable clothing of their own. Some came from the owners. Cast-offs were given or loaned for special occasions to reward favourites and to distinguish house slaves from field hands. While officially such practices were disapproved of and even expressly outlawed, in practice it was commonplace. Harriet Jones wore one of my mistress' dresses with a long train, accessorized with a scarlet sash, for her wedding. Preston, a slave who featured in a runaway advertisement in March 1847, was the owner of a new cloth velvet cap, which may well have been a gift. Others, figuring they may as well be hanged for a sheep as for a lamb, took whatever they could lay their hands on when they escaped. Rosa, an 11-year-old from New Orleans, made off with her owner's white silk hat, some handkerchiefs, lace tippets, and infant's clothing, most of which she may have intended to sell for cash to fund her flight. In other cases, it seems more likely that the garments taken were ones that had long been coveted. In 1814, Celia, a slave from Tennessee, took two calico frocks, one blue and the other yellow, a white cambric dress, two homespun dresses, a checked gingham bonnet, and, most intriguingly of all, a pair of red Morocco-eyed slippers, tied with yellow ribbons. Bacchus, a personal servant who fled Gabriel Jones's Virginia plantation on the 13th of June 1774, went all out. He had on, and took with him, two white Russia drill coats, one turned up with blue, the other quite plain and new, with white figured metal buttons, blue plush breeches, a fine cloth pompadour waistcoat, two or three thin or summer jackets, sundry pairs of white thread stockings, five or six white shirts, two of them pretty fine, neat shoes, silver buckles, a fine hat cut and cocked in the macaroni figure, a double-milled drab greatcoat, and sundry other wearing apparel. That so many black men and women owned and wore good clothing was a source of consternation to whites, upsetting their sense of the settled order of nature and society. Slave owners scoffed at slaves who they believed showed too fond an interest in their appearance, but they were unnerved too. An anonymous correspondent writing for the South Carolina Gazette in November 1744 complained that many of the female slaves are by far more elegantly dressed than the generality of white women below affluence. Plantations were filled with black women obliged to make thread, dye, fabric, and clothes for themselves and the other slaves who worked there. Tempe Herndon Durham, a former slave who was interviewed as part of the North Carolina Narratives Project, vividly recalled their skills. "The cardin and spinning room was full of niggers. I can hear them spinning wheels now turning round and saying, hum, hum, and hear the slaves singing while they spin. Mammy Rachel stayed in the dying room. There wasn't nothing she didn't know about dying. She knew every kind of root, bark, leaf, and berry that made red, blue, green, or whatever colour she wanted. And when she hanged them up on a line in the sun, there was every colour of the rainbow." What could be a source of pride to those working on plantations, however, was rarely appreciated by whites, who found the effect, often a mix of colours and styles, discordant and garish. Differences were accentuated at large celebratory social occasions, such as dances, church-going and weddings, when black people were observed indulging in sartorial displays suited to their own tastes. At a carnivalesque slave festival in Albany in the late 1790s, King Charles, a slave who officiated these events, paired a British scarlet military jacket decorated with gold lace with yellow buckskin small clothes and blue stockings. Patching and darning, a necessity when slave owners usually only provided one or two sets of clothes for their slaves each year, became stylish among slaves. Solomon's red and black sack may well have been parti-coloured because it had been patched or mended. Certainly, the adding of sections to let out clothes with no attempt to use a matching fabric was too common to be unintentional. One runaway ad, for example, mentioned a jacket with more blue in the forepart than back. White observers were unsettled to see an entirely separate set of rules in play. Fanny Kemble, wife of a Georgia plantation owner in the late 1830s, recalled the Sabbath toilet of their slaves as a ludicrous combination of incongruities. Every colour in the rainbow and the deepest possible shades blended in fierce companionship. In buying, acquiring, coveting, adapting, and styling clothing, slaves were participating in a cycle of consumption and display parallel to that of white Americans, and often incomprehensible to them. But this was not the only way in which slaves like Solomon were enmeshed in a global industry centering on the growth and production of cotton. Vegetable wool. Wild trees bear fleeces for their fruit surpassing those of the sheep in beauty and excellence, and the natives of India clothe themselves in cloths made therefrom. Herodotus, 445 BC. Although 18th century Europeans thought of cotton as an upstart, it already had a long history. Using DNA sequencing, scientists estimate that cotton, or Gossypium, has grown on Earth for between 10 and 20 million years. It is a very particular plant. It prefers warm temperatures of around 15 degrees with little to no frost and around 20 to 25 inches of rain each year, preferably concentrated in the middle of the growing period. These preferences limit it, for the most part, to a band around the globe roughly between 32 degrees south to 37 degrees north, taking in arid regions in Africa, Australasia, Asia, and Central and South America. In total, there are around 50 Gossypium species, which vary in height and size. Different strains are native to different regions. G. hirsutum in Central America, G. barbadense in South America, G. herbaceum in Africa, and G. arboretum in Asia. Whatever its other attractions, humans usually focus on one part of the cotton plant. Between 160 and 200 days after being planted, each plant produces a seed pod or boll in which the seeds are encased in pale strands of cellulose fibre. When ripened, the bolls break open to flaunt fluffy white innards like giant kernels of popped corn. It is likely that humans first worked out that they could use these fibres to make textiles and cordage in the Indus Valley. The earliest proven intentional use we know of was, like the flax fibres in the cave of Dzudzwana, stumbled across accidentally. Archaeologists were examining minute beads found in a Neolithic grave at Mergar, in what is now central Pakistan. Lying between the mountains and the Indus River, the site was a strategically important one, continuously occupied from the 7th millennium until the 1st millennium BC. The beads, thought to be the remains of a bracelet, were only a couple of millimetres in diameter and made from copper. When they were examined through a microscope, tiny traces of mineralized organic fibers were found snagged around the apertures. The metal had reacted with the threads that had been pulled through them, preserving microscopic traces of cotton that had been woven during the 6th millennium BC. Sophisticated cotton textiles have been produced in Asia, Africa, and the Americas for millennia. In 2016, fragments of indigo-dyed woven cotton textiles, some of which were up to 6,000 years old, were found at Huaca Prieta in North Peru, preserved by the hot, dry air. Cotton was so relied upon for the fibre it produced that it was one of the first plants to be domesticated, some 7,000 years ago. Domestication, as is its wont, changed the form of the plant itself. Sprawling, tall, wild species became, over time, smaller, more compact, and easier to harvest. Notwithstanding such adaptations, cotton remains difficult to farm. Not only does it have exacting requirements, it is also, particularly up until the invention and widespread use of machinery, incredibly labour-intensive to harvest. Traditionally, harvesting and sorting was done by hand. Fibres too short to be useful, called fuzz, are discarded, while the longer ones, lint, are ginned, a process that removes the seeds from the cotton without breaking the delicate fibres. Knots and dirt are then removed, and the fibres struck with a wooden bow to soften and make them more flexible. They are then carded, or combed, to separate and make them lie parallel, before being spun onto a distaff using a spindle. The thread is then ready to be woven into fabric. In almost every culture globally, it was women who were in charge of spinning cotton. Weaving was less strictly gendered. In India and Southeast Africa, for example, it was often done by men. One of the seeds for the great American cotton plantations was sown with Vasco da Gama's discovery of a direct sea route to India in 1497. Circumnavigating the Cape of Good Hope, although difficult and dangerous, was lucrative. It gave European traders direct access to Indian weavers and their wares, rather than relying on the more expensive and dangerous overland trade routes. The delicate patterns and use of colour characteristic of Indian textiles became immensely fashionable among Europeans. Daniel Defoe, who was not a fan, bemoaned it in the Weekly Review in 1708. "Indian calicoes," he wrote, "crept into our houses, our closets and bedchambers, curtains, cushions, chairs, and at last, beds themselves." By 1766, muslins and calicoes were so fashionable that cotton constituted 75% of the British East India Company's exports. Cotton fabrics were also being used by traders as grist in the mill of another market, the slave trade. The newly established and large-scale plantations of the Americas desperately needed cheap, abundant labour to make them profitable. With local populations decimated by disease and the remainder openly hostile to would-be farmers, a fresh labour had to be found. Slaves taken from existing trading posts on the west coast of Africa were deemed the ideal solution. Between 1500 and 1800, over 8 million people were transported from Africa to the Americas by the Spanish, Portuguese, French, British, Dutch, and Danish to serve as slaves. The British merchant Malachi Postlethwaite was hardly exaggerating when in 1745 he wrote, "Is it not notorious to the whole world that the business of planting in our British colonies, as well as in the French, is carried on by the labour of Negroes imported thither from Africa? Are we not indebted to those valuable people, the Africans, for our sugars, tobaccos, rice, rum, and all other plantation produce?" While it is often assumed that the currencies used to buy slaves were weapons or precious metals, a great many more were exchanged for cotton cloth. A study of the trades done by Richard Miles, a British slaver, between 1772 and 1780, for 2,218 slaves, found that textiles amounted to over half of the value of goods exchanged. At first, the cloth was bought from India. Later, raw cotton was imported to Europe, where it was woven with designs tailored for the African market. This was big business. Between 1739 and 1779, for example, Manchester's export trade expanded from a negligible £14,000 to £300,000 per annum. Roughly a third of this was bound for Africa to be exchanged for slaves. At first, Europeans found it difficult to satisfy African traders' demand for cloth themselves. They were discerning buyers, valuing bright, striped, checked, and patterned cotton cloths of the kind traditionally made in India and very different from those produced in Europe. It was a steep learning curve. Europeans scrambled to create saturated, colour-fast dyes and designs that could pass muster. The imitations they did create were often called, disingenuously, Indienne. Key to their eventual success was a steady stream of technological innovations that made spinning and weaving faster, more efficient, and, crucially, cheaper, finally allowing them to compete with and eventually supersede Indian-made cotton textiles. An early example of such innovation was the flying shuttle, invented in 1733 by John Kay. This was a small, aerodynamic piece of wood that could be quickly propelled from one side of the loom through the serried ranks of the warp to the other, dragging the weft threads with it as it went. This increased the speed of weavers so dramatically that afterwards it took four spinners to supply just one weaver. To correct this imbalance, inventors focused on improving the speed of the spinners. In 1764, James Hargreaves created the spinning jenny. 5 years later came Richard Arkwright's water frame, and a decade after that, the steam-powered mule was set in motion by Samuel Crompton. All exponentially improved the quantity of spun yarn. In 1785, Edmund Cartwright's power loom became the first steam-powered weaving machine. So much labour and time-saving mechanisation meant that, for the first time in history, cloth-making was being taken from hands and homes and transferred to machines and factories. For industrialists and merchants, of course, this made financial sense. While Indian spinners needed 50,000 hours to spin 100 pounds of raw cotton into thread by hand, a mule could accomplish the same task in a 50th of the time. The cost of yarn and cloth was therefore driven down, making European cloth competitive in the international market. Britain in particular invested heavily in new technology for cotton manufacture. By 1862, the country was home to two-thirds of the world's mechanical spindles. Between one-fifth and one-quarter of her population was involved in the industry, and almost half of all her exports were yarn or cloth. In 1830, a pound of British No. 40 yarn, a fine grade of thread, was three times cheaper than its Indian counterpart. Eventually, it became cheaper for subcontinental weavers to buy and use thread imported back from England. Fortunes were made by manufacture and trade of cotton. Samuel Touchett, for example, blossomed from Manchester cotton cloth manufacturer to wealthy and influential MP and political operator, able to contribute £30,000 to a government loan in 1757. His wealth and career were largely founded on producing checked guinea cloths for the African slave market. His home city also prospered, even as its proliferating factories coughed out ever more smog. Alexis de Tocqueville, a French diplomat and social commentator who visited the city in 1835, encapsulated the paradox. "From this filthy sewer," he wrote, "pure gold flows." The only limiting factor on this tide of wealth was the supply of raw cotton. For most of its history, cotton farming had been an addendum to household incomes. Farmers planted cotton alongside other crops, usually foodstuffs, which spread their risk. If one crop was attacked by blight or succumbed to some other natural menace, another might still survive and sustain them. And if their cotton failed entirely, then they would at least still be able to feed themselves. This made perfect sense for individual farmers, but it also meant that the transformation of the cotton lint into fabrics was usually done on a small, uncoordinated scale, fitting in around other household priorities and seasonal rhythms. Weavers and spinners controlled their hours, who they worked for, and the prices their work commanded, even if they had to give over some of their work as payment in kind for taxes or tributes. This did not suit colonialists, whose cotton-hungry factories needed reliable, large-scale farms dedicated to producing this one crop that could then be transformed into cloth and exchanged for money and slaves. Mills in Manchester and elsewhere continued to work efficiently only while there was a steady supply of cotton. Prior to the 1780s, achieving this supply had meant shipping it in from all over the world. Liverpool's docks were chocked with cotton from India, the Levant, the West Indies, and Brazil. Winners and pickers. The increase of that new material, cotton, must be of almost infinite consequence to the prosperity of the United States. George Washington, Letter to Thomas Jefferson, 1789. On the 4th of March, 1858, a Democrat from South Carolina took to the floor of the United States Senate and gave a speech still remembered to this day. Would any sane nation, he asked, make war on cotton? England would topple headlong and carry the whole civilized world with her, save the South. No, you dare not make war on cotton. No power on earth dares to make war upon it. Cotton is king. The use of power to force concession from those weaker than yourself was something James Henry Hammond was familiar with. He was 51, balding, double-chinned, and, despite his position in the Senate, a social pariah. 15 years earlier, it had been revealed that he had abused 4 teenage nieces. Their reputations were ruined thereafter. None ever married. There was an unusually high mortality rate on his plantation. In the 10 years from 1831 to 1841, 78 slaves, over a quarter of those inherited from his father, died. He had a long relationship with Sally Johnson, an 18-year-old he had purchased, and, once she turned 12, Sally's daughter Louisa. Both bore his children. All remained enslaved. In all social systems there must be a class to do the menial duties, he told his Senate peers during the same piece of oratory, to perform the drudgery of life. Fortunately for the South, she found a race adapted to that purpose to her hand. It has been estimated that in 1862, 4 years after Hammond gave his King Cotton speech, 20 million people worldwide, one out of every 65 people living, were involved in the cotton trade, either growing or transforming it into cloth. Even as Hammond spoke, raw cotton constituted just over 60% of the total value of all American products shipped abroad, and Britain, as he pointed out, had become hopelessly hooked on this supply. By the late 1850s, nearly 80% of the cotton consumed in Britain came from America. Cotton was grown in the Americas well before Europeans set foot there. One of the reasons why Christopher Columbus was so convinced that he had reached India in 1492, when he was, in fact, in the Caribbean, was that the islands were filled with cotton shrubs. On his first encounter with Arawak men and women, he wrote in his log that they brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things. Francisco Pizarro, too, when he reached the Inca Empire in what is now Peru in 1532, was impressed by the quality of textiles they produced, remarking that they were far superior to any they had seen, for fineness of texture and the skill with which various colours were blended. As elsewhere, however, up until the late 18th century, cotton remained one of many crops grown on a relatively small scale. Then American plantation owners, sensing opportunity in England's voracious appetite for raw cotton to supply her factories, began giving over vast new areas to intensive cotton farming in anticipation of equally vast profits. An earlier limiting factor for such large-scale farming had been the relatively small areas suitable for Sea Island cotton. This variant grew well only in coastal regions in the Caribbean and had a long staple length that was easy to harvest and gin. The cotton that grew best inland, however, was G. hirsutum, now known as American upland. At only 2 or 3 feet, this is a shorter shrub than Sea Island and has capacious, well-filled bowls. The problem is that the fibres these bowls contain are shorter and very tightly bound to the seeds, making the use of traditional gins time-consuming and unprofitable. A solution, however, was soon proffered. Eli Whitney, a young Yale graduate, learned of the difficulties of ginning American upland while staying on a friend's plantation in Georgia in 1793. Within a year, he had created a new kind of gin that efficiently combed out the seeds without breaking the delicate cotton fibres, secured a patent, and set up a factory in Connecticut to manufacture them en masse. With one hand-operated gin, a single person could clean 50 pounds of American upland cotton in a day. The effect of the expanded planting of cotton and the introduction of the new gin was dramatic. In 1790, South Carolina was exporting just under 10,000 pounds of cotton. In 1800, 7 years after the invention of the gin, this had increased to 6.4 million pounds. More cotton plantations, each with the capacity to produce and process a far bigger crop, meant more slaves. The slave population of Georgia nearly doubled in the 1790s to 60,000, and in South Carolina, the number in the new cotton-growing regions more than tripled, swollen by the addition of 15,000 shipped from Africa. The trend continued. Soon enough, the white farming population of the South was completely dwarfed by that of their slaves. In 1860, the 15 southern states had 819,000 white male farmers set against a slave population of 3.2 million. In some South Carolina districts, slaves made up 61% of all inhabitants. For the author of an editorial in The American Cotton Planter, written in 1853, slavery and cotton formed the warp and weft of America's success. The slave labor of the United States has hitherto conferred, and is still conferring, inappreciable blessings on mankind, they wrote. If these blessings continue, slave labor must also continue, for it is idle to talk of producing cotton for the world's supply with free labor. Of course, cotton had been produced for many thousands of years without slave labor and would, after the abolition of slavery, endure. But it was certainly the case that from the 1790s until the 1860s, the lives of many millions of American slaves were determined by the demands of King Cotton. John Brown was one of them. He was born around 1810 in Virginia. He was known sometimes as Benford, the name of his father's owner, and sometimes as Fed. But John Brown was the name he later took for himself and under which he published his memoir. His entire life was threaded through with cotton and the money to be made from it. He was 9 when he and his siblings were split up by lot, and he was sent to work on the plantation of James Davis, a small, thin man with a very cruel expression and a disposition to match. He would make his slaves work on one meal a day until quite night, and after supper, set them to burn brush or spin cotton. He later wrote, "We worked from 4 in the morning till 12 before we broke our fast, and from that time till 11 or 12 at night." Not long after his arrival at Davis's plantation, a considerable rise in the price of cotton led to a corresponding great demand for slaves in Georgia, and he was sold to a dealer. Prices were determined by weight. He fetched $310. Sometime later he stayed with one man, a very bad master but a very good preacher, famed for having the fastest cotton-picking Negroes in the whole county. This dubious accolade was earned by being set against their peers at rival plantations while owners bet on the outcome. During his time as a slave, He ploughed the fields for cotton, sowed it, plucked the worms from it, hoed around it, and picked the fluffy bolls from it. Although he never saw the profit from his labour, the money to be made from cotton determined the rhythm of his days. When the price rises in the English market, he wrote, even by half a farthing a pound, the poor slaves immediately feel the effects, for they are harder driven, and the whip is kept more constantly going. Field hands like Brown would work for long hours on short rations, work that was particularly punishing at picking time, when the field suddenly appeared snowbound and the crop was at its most vulnerable. Great speed was required, so the length of the working day increased. Moving down the rows, each soft white ball needed to be firmly grasped and twisted to detach it from the outer ball, now split open and star-shaped. Women, according to John Brown, picked faster than men, their fingers being naturally more nimble. But since all were forced to carry what they picked, as the baskets got heavier, the women would lag behind under their weight. Each basket, shaped like a hamper, could carry between 85 and 125 pounds. In 1863, during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which, on paper at least, granted over 3 million enslaved African Americans their freedom. Despite the fears of many in the South, the cotton industry continued to grow, and those growing it continued to prosper. One reason for this was the continuation, in one form or another, of enforced labour. Another was the development of a homegrown cloth industry. By the time of the Civil War, many plantations had begun to turn their own cotton crop directly into textiles, rather than exporting it and letting British mills reap the profits. Planters turned mill owners could sell finished cloth far cheaper than that shipped over from England. Soon enough, as the domestic market began to grow and flourish, American cotton gained its own independence from British merchants and the Atlantic slave trade. The Canadian Tuxedo. I wish I could invent something like blue jeans, something to be remembered for. Andy Warhol, 1975. The city of Elko, Nevada, held their fourth annual Silver State Stampede Rodeo on the 30th of June, 1951. It was a boisterous affair. The breeze carried competing scents of sugar, hot oil, horse sweat, and bravado. In the crowds, women in heeled sandals and cotton dresses linked arms with khaki-clad servicemen. Small boys in collared shirts and turned-up Levi's ogled the bucking cowboys they hoped they would one day emulate. When it came time for speeches, Bing Crosby, the singer, actor, and guest of honor, strode through the crowd grasping a pipe between his teeth and wearing a broad smile, an even broader cowboy hat, and an extraordinary jacket made from indigo-dyed cotton. The jacket was brand new, and so stiff that Bing had to wrestle one-handed with the buttons as he walked. It was too warm to wear it closed. Although he wore it with pride, its creation had been precipitated by a social humiliation. On a recent hunting trip to Canada, Crosby had been asked to leave a Vancouver hotel by a desk clerk because of his casual attire. He had been wearing Levi's waist overalls, or, as we would call them today, jeans. Luckily, he had finally been recognised by a bellhop whilst being firmly escorted off the premises. The brand, hearing of the incident and ever mindful of a marketing opportunity, made the singer a playful take on a tuxedo jacket, with thick, pale lapels, a corsage fashioned from their trademark red tabs and copper rivets, and a tongue-in-cheek label inside. Notice to hotel men everywhere. This label entitles the wearer to be duly received and registered with cordial hospitality at any time and under any conditions. Presented to Bing Crosby. Denim occupies a special place in the modern psyche. The anthropologist Daniel Miller began an informal experiment each time he went abroad for a conference. His work took him to places as culturally diverse as Seoul, Rio de Janeiro, Beijing, and Istanbul. He would count the first 100 people he saw on the street and make a note of how many wore blue jeans. It was usually over half. More rigorous studies confirm his findings. In 2008, people globally wore jeans 3.5 days each week. Germans were particularly keen, wearing them on average a little over 5 days a week and owning nearly 9 pairs. Americans had an average of 7 or 8 pairs and wore them for 4 days each week. In Brazil, where 14% of respondents said they had 10 or more pairs, 72% of respondents looked forward to wearing them. Even in India, where denim doesn't have nearly the same reach, 27% admitted that they loved donning their jeans. The attraction to blue jeans is complex. Crosby likely wore them because they were comfortable and casual. His Nevada ranches were his escape from Hollywood glitz. But they also had deep cultural resonance. They evoked cowboys, the Western states, and a certain kind of rugged individualism that bespeaks hard work, democracy, and freedom, a uniform in which one might attain the American dream. Simultaneously, as the attitude of the Canadian desk clerk suggests, they also made fine targets for snobbery. The reason for this prejudice lies in their origins as the humblest and hardiest of workwear. Levi Strauss, the man responsible for their commercial success, emigrated to New York from Bavaria in 1846. He travelled west to San Francisco as part of the gold rush 6 years later and set himself up as a merchant under his own name, selling dry goods to miners and other manual labourers. His big break came courtesy of a tailor from Reno called Jacob Davis, who had begun using metal rivets to reinforce the weakest points of his overalls, at the edges of the pockets and the bottom of the fly, where they would otherwise rip with prolonged wear and rough usage. "The secret of them pants is the rivets that I put in those pockets. I cannot make them up fast enough. My neighbours are getting jealous of these success." On the 20th of May, 1873, the pair were granted patent number 139,121, and their extra-tough overalls went into production. At first, they were offered in 2 fabrics, a heavy brown cotton similar to canvas, and denim, a tough, twilled fabric with a sturdy white warp overwoven with a weft coloured with indigo. This is why denim is paler on the reverse, where the warp threads show. It was already a well-established favourite for work clothes, and the more popular of the two. The name likely comes from its place of origin. It was originally a thick woolen serge cloth from the French city of Nîmes. Over time, the cloth was increasingly made elsewhere using cheap cotton, and the words Serge de Nîmes were mumbled down to denim. It was an early favourite of American mills. In 1864, East Coast wholesalers advertised 10 varieties, including New Creek Blues and Madison River Browns. Levi's waist overalls were an immediate success. The firm made much of their toughness. The leather patch sewn on the rear showed 2 horses trying and failing to pull a pair apart. By the 1920s, they were the leading men's work clothes in the Western states. In 1929, the same year the stock market crashed, Levi's posted sales of $4.2 million. It was during the 1930s that the cultural capital began to accrue. Romanticized westerns featuring stars like John Wayne captured the American and even global imagination. Jeans were an essential part of the cowboy wardrobe. East Coasters, nostalgic for a Wild West and noble ranch life they had never known, would buy them as souvenirs. Abroad, jeans were equally sought after. British teenagers clustered at the docks when merchant navy ships arrived, hoping to persuade American sailors to part with a precious pair of Levi's. It was during the late 1940s, As soldiers began returning from war in Europe, the genes became more subversive. In a prosperous, conformist era, when everyone was expected to settle down and procreate in the suburbs, there was growing anxiety about rough young men who showed no desire to be penned behind picket fences. Hollywood once again played a pivotal part. After 1953, jeans topped with leathers suddenly evoked town terror Marlon Brando in The Wild One. Paired with a t-shirt and red windbreaker, they were James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. With a humble cotton shirt, they became the uniform of the turbulent, troubled ranchman Dean played in Giant. Denim was transfigured in the public imagination, from the wardrobe of the Marlboro Man into an emblem of motorcycle boys and juvenile delinquents. Editorials scaremongered and schools rushed to outlaw jeans. Fearful that the bad boy reputation might depress sales, in 1957, Levi's ran an on-the-nose advertisement in newspapers showing a clean-cut lad, the inverse of Dean's rebel, wearing jeans above the slogan, "Right for School." The firm received hundreds of complaints. While I have to admit that this might be right for school in San Francisco, in the West, or in some rural areas, one woman from New Jersey wrote, I can assure you that it is in bad taste and not right for school in the East, and particularly New York. Of course, you may have different standards. Levi's needn't have worried. In 1958, a newspaper reported that about 90% of American youths wear jeans everywhere, except in bed and in church. 16 years later, in an essay for Rolling Stone, Tom Wolfe noted a similar phenomenon at Yale. Where once the college had been a bastion of preppy slacks and jackets, in 1974 there were more olive green ponchos, clodhoppers and parachute boots, bike leathers and more jeans, 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 more prole gear of every description. To further ram the point home, the article was illustrated with the design of a stitched back pocket, complete with Levi's tab. In decades since, the allure of jeans has remained undimmed, even while styles and the fortunes of individual companies have changed dramatically. Levi's nimbly rode the first youthquake wave. Their sales increased tenfold, from $100 million to $1 billion between 1964 and 1975. Thereafter, as successive subcultures put their own spin on the jean, customers proved fickle and the essence of cool more elusive. In the mid-1990s, underestimating the lure and longevity of baggy styles, the world's biggest purveyor of jeans experienced a 15% sales decline, forcing them to close factories and lay off staff. Our role, the company's 40-year-old youth marketing expert told the New York Times during a public relations blitz in 1999, is to be what's cool at that particular moment. The problem, however, is that what's cool to one kid is not necessarily cool to every single other kid. One concrete effect of the production of so many styles is the voracious consumption of cotton. Even now, when synthetics occupy a greater proportion of all the fibres used globally, cotton retains a 25% share. And while the tide is beginning to turn against plastics of all kinds, including fabrics, cotton retains a natural allure. But scratch the surface, and cotton is hardly the stuff of environmental dreams. In the 2016-17 season, an estimated 106.5 million bales of cotton, each weighing 480 pounds, were produced around the globe, requiring nearly 3% of the world's arable land. In 2011, demand outstripped supply, leading to an acute shortage. Cotton prices rose to $1.45 per pound, the highest in the history of the New York Exchange, higher even than the price reached during the embargo imposed by the South during the Civil War in the 1860s. In response, farmers planted more, but not before speculators had caused a panic on the stock market. The economics of cotton continued to have a profound effect on the lives of many people worldwide. The United States is the world's third largest producer, behind India and China, producing 3.7 million metric tons in 2016-17. Forced labor persists under the fig leaf provided by the 13th Amendment, which forbids slavery and involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime whereof the parties shall have been duly convicted. With just over 2 million people currently incarcerated in America, this makes for a large, cheap, and racially skewed labor force, a proportion of whom care for cotton crops almost entirely unremunerated. Prisoners, in other words, can be compelled to work, uncompensated or for a token amount, and if they refuse, punished. The financial incentives are clear. A federal program earned $500 million in sales in 2016. A Californian scheme generated $232 million. Transmuting cotton into usable fabric is also wasteful. A single pair of jeans requires 11,000 liters of water. Moreover, the majority of indigo used is now synthetic. Chemicals used and released during manufacturing and dyeing often end up in rivers and streams. In his 1976 essay, Lumber Thought, the Italian philosopher Umberto Eco argued that the modern obsession with denim was limiting rather than freeing. He found that the fitted shape of his jeans and the way they constricted his movement changed the way he carried himself. As a rule, I am boisterous. I sprawl in a chair. I slump wherever I please with no claim to elegance. My blue jeans checked these actions, made me more polite and mature. I lived in the knowledge that I had jeans on. It's strange that the traditionally most informal and anti-etiquette garment should be the one that so strongly imposes an etiquette. To him, denim was an armor, which made its wearers focus on how they appeared in the world around them, on exterior things rather than interior. He empathized with any woman, enslaved chiefly because the constrictive clothing counseled for her by society forced her psychologically to live for the exterior. And this makes us realize how intellectually gifted and heroic a girl had to be before she could become, in those clothes, Madame de Sévigné, Vittoria Colonna, Madame Curie, or Rosa Luxemburg. The story of cotton is varied, from the part it played in the slave trade to technological revolutions. We may have domesticated cotton millennia ago, but perhaps, in the final reckoning, it may be that cotton has had a greater impact on us.